And we're back on News Radio KMAN. In Focus continues. We're talking Manhattan City Manager Ron Fear and Mayor Yush Eredi this hour as the City Commission has their 7 o'clock meeting tonight. We haven't quite got into the agenda yet, so why don't we do that here in the next segment. Just one agenda item tonight. It's a discussion item talking about community development block grant. And I'll let Ron take this one away.
Sure. Thanks, Brandon. This is... again, normally what we would be doing is covering our five-year plan. So we have Manhattan's an entitlement community as far as community development block grant proceeds go. And as such, we have to develop a five-year strategic plan or a consolidated plan that will go from July 1st of 2020 through June 30th of 2025, and it sets out some strategic goals for how those funds should be utilized over that 5 year. And then also, we tend to cover the 2020 annual action plan. So that 2020, again, would start July 1st of this year. The amount of proceeds that we've been allocated for that is $559,229. We've been an entitlement community now since we've been over 50,000, so roughly 10 years, and this will be our third consolidated planning process. So the current plan really focuses on how we utilize these funds to help low and moderate income folks in the community. That's the target. Folks, so projects and programs that benefit low and moderate income families or individuals or other threatened individuals or weaknesses in our community. So, or needs, I should say, community needs. So specifically for 2020, the original plan was to look at our housing rehabilitation program, where we would set aside about $181,000 for that program. This is a program that we've had for many years and have targeted assistance to low and moderate income homeowners that have worked hard to stay in their homes. And this helps them with ADA access, with critical improvements to heating and air conditioning, water heaters, just some of the key things you need in a home to live and survive well. And so it also does some amounts to emergency repairs. And so that's been a good program that's helped a lot of folks. Another one is in public services. And this would be where we help locations like the emergency shelter, different programs around the community that help with our social services. There's about $84,000 targeted for that. We are traditionally limited to only being able to use 15% of the proceeds for those public services. We also... looking at public facilities and infrastructure. We've utilized this in the past for improvements at the senior center as an example, down at the Douglas Community Center, as well as various infrastructure in the community like sidewalks and ADA ramps, that sort of thing. And so a lot of the improvements were targeted for that to be used as well, and then about 20% goes to program administration that funds the person for overseeing these grants as well as the person that we hire to run the housing rehab program. So that's kind of the limitation for that. We have received notice. Actually, we just got the letter today that there is some specific assistance that's been approved in the most recent CARES Act, and that is so entitlement communities are getting a percentage of their normal allotment to help with COVID-19 concerns, and that amount is almost $329,000, which we should have here within about 30 days or so, and it can be used for any type of variety of needs in the community. It can be used to really help with temporary medical facilities. It's fairly flexible in how we utilize it. They're also indicating that we can readjust this plan I was just talking about and how we spend those categories. They've raised or eliminated the 15% cap on the public services. So that could be something that I'm sure we'll talk about tonight. And we've also, they're allowing us, if we have unspent funds from 2019, which is in the current year, which we do, we have a couple of sidewalk projects, one that's actually out to bid and another one about to go out to bid, those funds can be reprioritized to help with COVID-19 needs in the community. So I'm sure that'll have some discussion tonight, and it's certainly a good opportunity for us to do. Again, the primary emphasis on this program is to provide projects and programs that benefit low and moderate income individuals and families.
You know, I'm curious. Yeah. A little bit of with that, the emergency shelter, I know I spoke to them a couple weeks ago about some of the challenges that they're having. Would some potential money then be coming to them pretty quickly here if they needed to maybe house some folks temporarily?
It could, yes. And so that's part of what this could do would be to provide additional assistance, whether that's contracting with hotels or other entities to help provide additional relief if that's necessary, or food and supplies to help take care of the people that they have.
All right, very good. Did you have something, Yusha, you wanted to say?
Sure, yeah, I was going to say, you know, the CWD funds have always been a good funding source for the needs, primarily, like Ron was mentioning, for individuals that are in a low or moderate income or low and moderate income level, whether it's housing or their facilities. But this is also kind of like a bridge to a lot of our social service agencies that just need a little extra boost or an extra amount of money to move forward with some of their programs or some of their infrastructure needs in their own buildings and resources. And I think this provides, $500,000, I wish it was a lot more than that, but each year that we get something of that amount, there's a huge need for it. There's a whole application process and a team that reviews all of these applications and allots the money as needed. But every single community always needs the CWD funds. And in this time for the pandemic and COVID-19, I'm glad that the federal government is allotting a little bit more money to meet those needs. Things that we don't anticipate, but this is what we're going to use to help the people. Like I said, if they have a tested positive, to find a place for them to be, so they're away from their families, so we can take care of those funding sources as well. I think it's going to be a good discussion. I think the public is going to be highly involved in these discussions, because these are monies that we don't discuss as frequently as we need to. But if we don't utilize them, as we need to right now, we're going to lose that in the end. So I'm glad we're going to have this discussion and plan forward for how to utilize them even better.
I might just highlight some of the original recommendations. For example, in the public service area was funding for the emergency shelter, as well as funding for Pawnee Mental Health, Sunflower CASA, Kansas Legal Services, and Housing and Credit Counseling. So one of the things that we've done in the past is utilize the Social Service Advisory Board to review applications that folks that are interested in these funds, and they help make some of those recommendations. So as we look at potentially increasing the amount in these areas, we might also consider other social service agencies that might see some surge in some some of their work, such as the Crisis Center, maybe Shepherd's Crossing, maybe even the food banks and the bread basket, some of those that you see in other areas as unemployment continues to grow, the meeting the food needs becomes more of a challenge. So I think it's an area that we're certainly need to be cognizant of and be able to step in and assist if we need to.
Right. And also collect the data for the housing study, the homeless needs that we might be having in our community, workforce training. So this is to help our community work better and get stronger, especially during this crisis. But even without the crisis, we were working on some of these initiatives. So I think the homeless one really bothers me a great deal because it's hard to get a sense of the homeless rate in any community. The school district may have some data points, but we as a community need to figure out this population a little bit better.
Yeah. We have a caller on the line here. I believe it's Paul. Go ahead. Good morning.
Okay. Maybe you've discussed this and I missed it, but I was thinking about something yesterday. If the students don't register here, that they're living here and they register at home, and we've got about 16,000 boots on the ground. If we lose 10,000 of them, that takes our population down below the, I think we were called the metro area. And I know we got more money at that time. What happens to that situation and what happens? Where do we get that money we've been getting? And they talk about extending it to August to register, but I don't think that's going to happen. I'll just hang up and listen.
All right. Did you catch on?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion about the census and the impact it's going to have, especially on university communities that are traditionally counted where the student is on April 1st, which is typically at school. So I know the university has worked hard to communicate with their students that have gone home, and that encourages them to touch base with the Census Bureau. I mean, most of them, they get something in the mail, but a lot of the responses are online. So there'll be a lot of coordination from the university with their student body to be able to try and amend those. And then we'll just have to see how those come out. Whether or not there's an appeal process, they've talked about a number of methodologies. For example, there's been some discussion about basically leaving it somewhat to some of those institutions to submit collective data. So currently, for example, all of the folks that live in dorms on campus or some of the other living groups, the university already reports them as part of their university population. The students themselves don't do that report. Likewise, the military does something very similar as to where folks are stationed. So if they're deployed, they still get, and they're overseas somewhere away from their duty station, they still get reported by the Army or the other, whatever armed services it is, as being in the population of the duty station. So there's been some discussion of broadening that to allow folks to those institutions to who can show addresses for those students based on where their records are as being in the community, or if they live outside the community, of being able to assist with this kind of a group count effort. So we call it a group quarters. Our nursing homes also are in that category, those type of things where the individual residents don't respond to the census, but the administrators of that facility report those numbers.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was going to add to this. Sorry, Ron, were you done?
I'm done, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So one of the things there we're also going to be kind of pushed out to this is when students left, some of them already left, so closed off their apartments and went home, mom and dad, wherever they might be in a different community. So we want to make sure they're also registering onto the census as though they, where would they have lived on April 1st? And this pandemic has not made that easy. But this is going to be true for everybody in the nation right now, trying to gather those data points, because they are so relative to the funding sources that we get from the federal agencies. So it falls on us to really either call, you know, we used to have it where we had hourly workers that were going to knock on doors and collect this information. But now they can't go outside and knock on people's doors and do all of that. So we're still going to find out ways where, whether it's phone calls or make connections with them and make sure they turn it in. The census is not on the forefront of most people's minds right now, but it's extremely important so that we have the resources to meet the needs in our communities, because students will come back, but it's going to matter that we count them as they were here on April 1st. And unfortunately, everybody was leaving right before April 1st. So that's why we need to... And there's a whole task force working on this for the city of Manhattan as well as Kansas State University, and we're going to continue some of those initiatives aggressively to make sure we get an accurate count.
Yeah, and Manhattan's not alone. There's a lot of towns that are having the same issue. Right. I'm sure Lawrence is having the same questions right now as well. So
absolutely.
Well, let's take a break here. We'll come back and continue our conversation with City Manager Ron Fear, Mayor Mike Mayor Yusheretti, and we will come back after this on InFocus.